I'm Elena Landsberg-Lewis, your host of Grandmothers on the Move, the podcast that kicks old stereotypes to the curb. Come meet these creative, outrageous, authentic, adventurous, irreverent, and powerful disruptors and influencers. Grandmothers, from the living room to the courtroom, making powerful contributions in every walk of life. We know them most intimately as loving caregivers, the older women in our lives with a thousand stories about their grandchildren and pictures in their purses. In this podcast, you'll come to know even more about our grandmothers. They are galvanized, determined, and are guaranteed to get you thinking. What drives them? What are they up to? What is the potential of grandmother power, and how is it changing the world? Grandmothers are on the move. You don't want to be left behind. Hi, it's Elena. Welcome back to Grandmothers on the Move. And today I have a delicious conversation for you with Natalie Levant. And I'm just going to read from a short paragraph that I assume, Natalie, you wrote to describe yourself on a website somewhere. And it says, I am a stand-up comedian rejected by the AARP, can't knit or needlepoint, don't know my place, in quotation marks, and don't want to. Old folks tell me I'm an inspiration. Youngsters want to take me home. The rest can't believe what they're seeing, hearing, especially since I should be home ironing my skin. Follow your dream and or keep moving. It's harder to hit a moving object. By the way, gray hair is for bats. Welcome, Natalie. It's wonderful to have you on Grandmothers on the Move.
Oh, thank you. It's delightful to be here, really.
It's wonderful to have you. You are the very first comedian that I have had on the podcast. So
really?
I've been practicing trying to be amusing so I can match you.
It won't be difficult.
Thank you. You're very kind. I want to move from the tame to the outrageous. So we'll ease in. I wanted to ask you how you started this career as a comedian. What possessed you post 80 to step into the fray and take up a mic?
Well, I had been kind of floundering around after I lost my dear husband. We were married 55 years, and the first few years, I really didn't quite know what direction to go in. I wanted to keep moving. As I said, deciding it's harder to hit a moving object. But wherever I moved, I just didn't feel comfortable. I didn't feel comfortable at the nail salon. I had nothing to contribute to the discussions about cruises and what the ladies were making for dinner. This went on for a few years, and one day I was volunteering at a site in Philadelphia called Siloam, which is a wonderful resource for folks who are dealing with HIV. And a gentleman and I were stuffing envelopes and I guess being silly, and at one point he said to me, have you ever thought of doing stand-up comedy? I love stand-up comedians, but I really couldn't absorb the question. I just said, no. He said, well, go and see a friend of mine who is hosting a quote-unquote summer camp at Taboo. He said to me, do you know where Taboo is? I said, of course I do. That's the wonderful gay nightclub. And off I went and did my thing, and they laughed. And I think that was the beginning of creating a monster. They just supported me so totally that I thought, oh my God, this is really fun. I'm up here telling mostly about my life, and they think it's funny. So that's how it all started.
How does it feel standing up in front of a crowd of people? It's really putting yourself out there. And I've watched some of the videos of you doing your comedy. You really do draw from your own life. I mean, the whole thought terrifies me. It's a kind of vulnerability. I guess it's a two-part question. How do you experience it? And how has it changed over time for you?
In terms of how I experience it, it's, I guess, what you would call an uneven love fest. Because whatever I give out to the crowd, the room, they give me back 100 times over. And when I did go to Taboo the first time to perform, I didn't know what to do for the stand-up. And I knew that I was supposed to make people laugh. So I just sat down and wrote the only thing that I really knew, which was my life. and tried to make the things that were not funny a little bit humorous, and then the things that were funny, funnier. But it's a give and take. And on those good nights, the crowd gives me back so much. And all my life, I have been a quote-unquote Broadway babe. I have always loved theater. I think when I was born, Alana, and the doctor spanked me, I really think that I thought it was applause. And I've been seeking it in one way or another ever since.
Am I right that you started 8 or 9 years ago, Natalie?
I started 7 years ago, yes, when I was 81.
Have you found that either your comedy has changed or your feeling has changed about standing up in front of people and doing this?
I would say that both have evolved. I think I've gotten, I know that I've gotten edgier as I've gotten more comfortable. Over the years, I did do community theater and dinner theater, and I did a one-woman show. So it wasn't as much getting up in front of a crowd. It was getting up in front of a crowd and saying my words, not the words of somebody else, and words that were supposed to be funny, but honest. The comedians that I have always admired, just worshipped in some cases, have always been the comedians who have been honest, who have been up there and told their truths. That's what I've always tried to do.
And I wanted to ask you about that, because one of the things that shouldn't be remarkable, but it is that the truths that you're speaking, your own truths, you're speaking as an older woman. And that's so, so rare. I mean, it's rare in almost any field, but it's certainly rare in comedy. And I think I read somewhere that at first you were worried about whether it would speak to a younger audience. What's been your experience with that?
When I started comedy, I was absolutely certain that if there were any folks out there who were going to laugh, it was going to be older people. And I would think, well, I better not perform if there isn't going to be an older crowd. And quite to the contrary, after a number of shows, these youngsters whom you referred to earlier would come up and say, oh, take me home. I want you to be my grandma. Oh, and they used to say mother. Now they say grandma. But in answer to your question, folks will come up to me, of course, after a show, and they say many different things. But one of the things that I so often get is, oh, is everything that you talk about up there true? And I always say to them, well, why would anyone want to make that up? So that's my answer to that. And the flip side, and I guess this is the very best part of doing stand-up, are those folks who come up and say, oh, you know what? I'm going to take those guitar lessons, or I'm going to sit down and write that book of poetry that I didn't think anybody would want to read. And, you know, that's what keeps you going, truly.
Yeah, of course. It's totally inspiring. And I hope everyone watches the videos and goes to see your shows who are in the Philadelphia area, because you are absolutely hilarious. But you're also absolutely irreverent. You don't pull any punches. And when you say you've gotten edgier as you get older, I don't know what you were like before, but edgier is right. There's no topic that's off limits. And that must have been a decision, though, right? To tell it straight and to use colorful language.
It really wasn't a conscious decision. I don't think that I even realized when I started this madness. I didn't apply it to myself, quote unquote, clean versus edgy versus beyond edgy. And it was just really part of getting up there and sharing my thoughts. And, you know, this is such a hot topic. Just how far should a comic go? What is edgy? What is off limits? And I think for each of us, we have to make that decision. You're always going to run the risk of offending someone or ones, but that's the nature of comedy. And I think that you have to live your truth. And that's what I try to do. And if that means sometimes using language or going down roads that some folks think I should not travel, it has to be my truth.
I wonder how you feel about the challenges to comedy and how it's changing. You know, with the Louis C.K.'s and the Bill Cosby's and whatnot, there is a challenge at this moment to the comedy. It seems to me that women who are comedians are playing an incredibly important role in ripping off the Band-Aid.
Well, this is a really complicated area. Most of the male comedians who have what I consider crossed the line, certainly Bill Cosby, Louis C.K., whatever, I never thought they were funny. I didn't think they were honest, so for me, they were not humorous. Your question covers a lot of areas, because being my age, I also am very aware of ageism and how it spills over into real life, and then, of course, real life, aka comedy. And when I first walk on stage, people out there do not know me. They just are hearing an introduction. Of course, there'll be a few people out there, whatever, who do know me. But for the most part, since I perform kind of in the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, Delaware, of course, Philly, there are mostly people who are seeing me for the first time. And when I walk on stage, I usually just stop and tell the audience it's okay, they can take a breath and put their cell phones away. They don't have to call 911. My family isn't looking for me, and so on and so forth. So in terms of how comedy has changed, I really can't comment too much on the misogynistic side of it, because I call it as I see it. When you get up there and you need to try to be funny at the expense of someone's sexuality or someone's age or your quote-unquote sexual prowess, then you're just not funny to me.
Agreed. But you really do take on every stereotype and mine your own life and people's assumptions to the max. I think people end up laughing with a kind of astonishment at some of the things you say that they don't expect an older woman to say or a grandmother to say, or even how you talk about being a grandmother. And I wonder if you can tell me a little bit about that.
Well, here again is where we go into the stereotypical ageism. When your children are grown and your quote-unquote job is done, there's a certain role that you're just automatically expected to play. I mean, how many times when you meet someone that you haven't seen for a long while, or maybe even just someone that you've just met, one of the first questions is, how many grandchildren do you have? And right. This is supposed to be your identity. Or do you have a good recipe for a green bean casserole? And this is not what my idea of getting older is. And I never thought about it consciously until, as I said, a few years after my husband passed away, and I just didn't fit in. I wasn't able to participate in the kind of conversations and the kind of lifestyle that I was expected to have at this point in my life. I was asked a question recently after one of the articles came out, when your friend suggested that you try stand-up, did you ever think, oh, at my age? And that's the one thing that, for whatever reason, I never thought. And I don't think I really realized how old I was and should I be doing this. But it keeps going back to what is expected of women as they get older and older and older. And at what age should you decide I'm too old? Well, I haven't decided that I'm too old yet. You know, you need to be comfortable in your own skin. But I guess I'm just going to keep going down that road, fighting and screaming and saying, no, no, no. No, I will do this.
I'm grateful for that, Natalie.
You know, I have been forced to start thinking about my age only because it has now become a topic. I would have much preferred that just my humor would have given me these 5 minutes of fame. But apparently, I now have to, oh, God, am I that old? That's really old. I wonder how I should feel. You know, we all have to feel how we're comfortable feeling, but just don't let society tell you how you should feel. I guess if I had, you know, one thing to say, you decide, not your kids, not some how to age gracefully nonsense. You decide what feels good, and then let the chips fall where they may.
I love that. I might just put that on a poster.
Really, just, you know, I get like maniacally intense when stereotypes of any kind, and I have always, I guess in many ways, ignored them without realizing that I was maybe marching to my own drummer. But it's so wrong. You can't have kids anymore. But everything else you pretty much can do. I mean, you got to be healthy. Every 5 minutes, I feel grateful that at this point, everything seems to be working, even my two fake hips. Everything seems to be working. And if it's not, God, just do the best you can. And I hope you feel loved and have someone to love. And
you have quite a community of people around you who really love you. That's clear.
Well, the comedy community has really been very warm. From day one, here again, I'm talking about never giving any thought to, oh my God, you know, look how old I am and they're so young. It never occurred to me. And I have to, in large measure, thank all the comedians with whom I worked and work that they have never given off that vibe. Never.
Well, and that's how it should be, right? First and foremost, you're a comedian. I'm listening to you and I hear what you're saying, and it's true. This happens, I think, for comedians who are people of color or comedians who do their acts very openly from the LGBTQ community or from any marginalized, historically discriminated against group, that becomes the curiosity, that becomes the thing to talk about. And I hear you on that clearly, and it's true. There's an injustice to it. And on the other side of it, though, in your case, when I'm watching some of the videos of you, I'm looking at the faces of the people in the audience as the camera across them. You know, they get over there, oh my God, this is an older woman, that's not who we expected, pretty quickly. And they're just joining the ride and having a raucous time with you. And I actually find it quite powerful, Natalie. I really do.
I thank you for that.
You don't just come out as an older woman, you rock the wardrobe. And you have tattoos.
I do. Well, of course, I was younger. Look, I was younger yesterday. I'm aging rapidly. And I was much, quote unquote, much older when I got my first tattoo. But there again, I don't remember ever thinking that I wonder if I should get a tattoo at my age. I don't think I've ever used the expression at my age. But my first tattoo, and it's really talking to you in Toronto, if I may indulge, the story of my first tattoo, please, which is a spider. I have always, as I said earlier, loved the world of theater. And my daughter and my sister and I went to New York to see, we thought, Cheetah Rivera in Kiss of the Spider Woman. Now, I have been blessed. I have seen a lot of theater over the years. We went to see Cheetah, and I forgot, and I love Cheetah Rivera, I forgot that she was in it because there was an actor, Brent Carver, who, this is the 6 degrees of separation, calls Toronto his home. His performance was so mesmerizing. One of those, I can't get up from my seat performances. I can't move. That I got a spider, and I owe it all to Brent Carver, whom I hope is well and happy and just one of the most talented actors I have ever, in my 88 years, had the privilege of seeing. And he gave me wonderful, wonderful memory. So that's the story of my first tattoo. He's totally responsible for my getting one at my age. Then, of course, that was followed by 3 more. And I would love to get more. But the last time I got a tattoo, quite a few years ago, I have to say, Tony, who did the tattoos, he was really far more worried than I, because let's just say that you don't have real thick skin as you get older. You can have it maybe metaphorically, but you don't walk around with it.
Right.
So, and the ink started to run. That's not a good look.
Right.
It just, no.
They certainly have an impact.
Who said that, you know, as you get older, you should cover your body, cover your arms, so that your upper arms don't look like bags of dead mice? No, just, you know, it's your body. Be proud. I don't like people who preach, and I sound like I'm preaching, and I really don't mean to. If you see something and you want to wear it, it doesn't look ridiculous, maybe in somebody else's eye, but that's their problem.
Absolutely.
I always say, take your daughter-in-law with you, and if she says you just look absurd, buy it. Buy you, whatever you, you know, sometimes you'll take something out and you say, I must have been nuts
right.
when I bought that. But that's fine. Now you're a new nuts. With me, it's usually something I'll look at, why in the world? That's like for an old woman.
Oh, that's interesting.
That's, really? I would never wear that. Yeah. I was trying to please my sons. Now, I'm done. No, I'm not wearing that.
And I have the pleasure of speaking to a lot of women who are my senior. And the kind of liberation that they feel, they just don't give a damn anymore about some of the things that dogged them when they were younger. And some women never felt that way. Like my own mother never felt that way. She was always her own person, and she was always living out loud. But a lot of women that I speak to in their 70s and 80s say that there is a kind of freeing of the spirit, freeing of the person that's even beyond what they might have had when they were younger. And I find myself feeling kind of jealous because I'd like to get there.
That's really interesting because, you know, I only know you through our media connection, but you sound as though you have a sense of feeling, quote unquote, relatively free. You sound confident. You said your own mom always was her own person. Don't you think that that probably, now I'm interviewing you.
That's right.
Don't you think that you probably are much freer than you realize, because I feel it coming from you.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that. I do actually think that relatively speaking, now in my 50s.
Oh my God, you're a baby.
There you go. Oh. It's the truth, I confess.
Oh.
But I'm beginning to arrive. With every year that passes, I get closer.
Well, first of all, I'm still reeling that you're in your 50s. Here's where I insert Milton Berle, Uncle Milty's line.
Right.
I have dresses older than you. Oh, my God. Yeah, for a long time, I think when our oldest son was born, it took us 6 years to get up the courage to have a second child because he defied all of the baby books. He did not do anything that he was, quote unquote, supposed to do, including sleeping, chewing food. Long story short, he was reading when he was 2.5 and still hadn't slept the night through. And for any child, but for a first child, it was absolutely terrifying. Somehow, some part of me and my husband who supported it, we didn't take any advice. We took him in and out of 4 schools. We never gave him any medication. When he was almost 3, we went to Atlantic City for a few days, and it was the first time he slept the night through. But long story short, I think that that experience of having whatever it was inside of me, us, to do it our way. And today he's a successful bankruptcy attorney, and he still marches to his own drummer. But I think the experience of kind of going it alone without consciously realizing that it had changed me was powerful. And then I got involved in what we called at the time the independent political movement, which was basically African Americans having a voice in Philadelphia politics, particularly under the reign of the police commissioner at that time, who was very cruel and very racist. And I developed friendships that I have to this day. It was just, a powerful experience. One of the candidates who had no chance to have a voice in politics is today still a dear friend and also a United States congressman. I'm still very close to many of the people. We go way back to the late 60s, early 70s, and I guess it started because I got involved in the campaign of the first African American to run for mayor in Philadelphia, the late Hardy Williams. And we didn't make it, but in a way we made it. It meant we had backyard barbecues, motorcades. I had a cross burned on my lawn. We had death threats, but we grew stronger and mightier. And of course I got involved. Why would I not get involved? Right. But apparently it was kind of a unique thing to do in the eyes of a lot of people. I had the honor years back of meeting the late Elijah Cumming and John Lewis. And these are the things in your life that make you realize what matters and what doesn't matter. Maybe that even ties into getting up there on stage and living your truth. And if you have a problem with that, or some word that offends you, just go and find something to do with your life that matters.
You know, it's so interesting, Natalie, because there is a really long and honorable history of comedians challenging the world as we know it.
Oh, yes. Through humor. Yes. Oh, yes. Well, look what Mel Brooks did with Hitler. I can't tell you how many times I went back to see the producers. One of the best compliments that I ever received since I started doing stand-up 7.5 years ago, a gentleman told me that, how can I be humble enough to say it, but that I reminded him of Moms Mabley.
Wow, that's a wonderful...
Yeah, okay. Oh, my God. Yeah. I mumbled some incoherent thank you because I was just too overwhelmed, but your point of, yes, social injustice, social commentary, every comic who picks up a mic and walks on stage should stop and say thank you to Richard Pryor. A lot of, I guess, times you don't even realize when you're laughing because it's so true, and sometimes you're laughing because it's so painfully true. Oh, my God. I remember Moms Mabley. There's a special on her that Whoopi Goldberg produced. If you can find it, it's just quite unforgettable. But she talks about how when she would be driving and the light would turn to green, she would wait to let the other cars with the white people go first. And that's funny, but that's not funny. And what are we talking about in the 60s, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Painful humor is a big, big part of what can enlighten and move us.
Yes. Yes. That we might not want to remember it, or we might not want to like hear what the message is, but hopefully we do. As they have on my video online, I'm so proud, Ilana, it says, warning, explicit language. I've seen film of audience reaction to the first time in Chicago before the producers went to Broadway. The audience, they were stunned. They couldn't believe what they were seeing. Look, I was born in 31. I remember. So what do we do? Do we go down Mel Brooks Road, or what do we do? Does it lessen the pain? I don't know. Is it offensive? Probably. I saw David Muir had part of his newscast a couple weeks ago, and he was interviewing at Auschwitz a few of the survivors, and particularly one woman who was just so eloquent and just had to bring you to tears. And I said, I'm never doing any more of those quote-unquote jokes. I don't know. Will I? Won't I? I don't know.
It's also the context that we're living in. I mean, it has to have something to do with what's going on around us as well.
Right.
This comedy, right. Where it lands in the moment.
Right.
some of this stuff, I'm sure, changes according not just to how you're feeling or what's happening with you, but what's happening in the world and the culture around you.
Exactly. And is it worth the laugh? Those of us with strong political feelings, I cringe when I see a post on Facebook wishing the demise of one of the elected officials, whom you, of course, differ with is mild. But no, not wishing something horrible happen to this human being, you know. But then I go down the path with Ricky Gervais. If you have harmed an animal, if you just aren't on my radar anymore.
Right.
I don't think I've told you I plan to have him open for me one of these days.
He should only be so lucky, Natalie.
Oh, thank you. I'm listening to myself and I'm thinking, you've got to get a grip, Natalie.
You make connections with people in so many ways, Natalie. It's really astonishing and fantastic and inspiring how many different ways you have found to make the human connection with a very wide group of people.
I thank you for that. I said I needed to say something, and this is probably a good time because of what you said. Whatever I am able to give, most of the time not consciously, but give to another person, that's my daddy and me. He had the biggest influence in my life. A man with little education, but everybody on two legs, everybody on four legs mattered. And he gave me my wings.
Wow.
He really, really did. His name was Harry Kaufman, and I carry him with me everywhere. I remember he passed away. I was, I don't know, it was 1971, so I was 40. And I remember I had been out campaigning for Hardy, whom I talked about earlier, and my husband was sitting in the living room. It's like 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and my husband was never home at that hour. He was an attorney, and he was all kinds of hours. And I walked in the house, and we had the three boys. We didn't have Hallie yet. We adopted her in 73. And I walked in, and there was my husband, and he told me my daddy had passed away. And I guess this will give you an idea of the power that I felt he had, the strength. And I just looked at my husband and I said, oh no, oh no. I said, Daddy would never do that to me.
Oh God.
Really? Yeah.
That resonates deeply for me because I have an equally powerful relationship and influence in my life with my own father. And I know how deep that runs. And it's not just about boundless love, which is wonderful, but it's also just how we learn to live the way we think is right in the world.
Yes, yes, yes. And it's easy to make somebody who is already, quote unquote, an important person, it's easy to smear them, but to make a little person feel big, feel important. He had that gift. He was a gift.
Yeah. Do you think you got your humor from him too?
Yes, when you know, sometimes when I just can't handle something, yeah, he just pops up. Yes, the answer to the question. The answer to the question is yes.
Before I let you go, I want people who are listening to know, where can they find you?
Well, you can find me on Facebook, Natalie K. Levant.
Natalie, I love talking to you.
This, thank this you. So you could not have enjoyed this as much as I have.
Be well.
Thank you, Alana. You as well, and your beautiful family. Hug your daddy for me.
I will.
And sending my love.
Me too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, my friend.
Thanks for listening. I'm Ilana Landsberg-Lewis, your host of Grandmothers on the Move. If you want to find out more about me or the podcast, go to grandmothersonthemove.com and come back next week for another episode.